everyone, and welcome to Minute 90 of Season 10 of Movie Raw Minute, the daily podcast, where we hijack our way through the 1974 action thriller, The Taking of Pelham 123, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again to finish off this week is Alex Marcus, the podcast director of PopBreak.com. Welcome back to the show, Alex.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me back one last time. I can't wait. I'm just going to adjust my standing right here, get my footing grounded, so that way nothing bad happens to me.
Just don't fall down when we eventually come to a complete stop.
Don't worry. I've got excellent subway riding balance.
Okay. That works. It's important when you're on a careening a subway car.
It's a skill. You got to build. Every New Yorker, real New Yorker, knows how to not fall down when you're on a 70-mile-an-hour runaway subway cart.
Have you ever been on one that's on a runaway 70 miles an hour?
Yeah, sure. It happens like once every 3 months in the city. You know, it's just a part of life. We just deal with it. It's no big deal.
Wait, with hijackers or without?
Without. It just, you know, sometimes they like to give us a little bit of a surprise in our morning routine, you know.
Okay. All right, that's fair.
Got to keep things fresh. Keep things exciting.
Definitely makes sense. All right. So
the MTA, that everybody knows that about the MTA. They're just a bunch of jokers.
That's right. That's true. So minute 90 begins with Green taking off and ends with the passengers continuing to go crazy. So we left things off yesterday with Blue getting ready to return fire on the mysterious person who's shooting at them. Green getting a little bit upset and scared and being told, okay, just go where we told we're going to meet. And so this minute basically begins with Green not arguing. He just gets up and goes. Now, did you notice what he does when he's walking up the stairs?
No.
He takes the bloody wad of money out of Gray's pocket that we talked about yesterday.
Oh, yes, he does. I did see that, yeah.
So.
Classic beginner mistake.
Well, he doesn't get caught because of that, but yeah.
Well, but certainly once he gets caught, that's not going to help. I'm going to make that plausible deniability a lot harder to maintain.
Yeah, that's true. It's a good point.
Because in a court of law, you know, again, not to spoil anything, but in a court of law, having also sneezed is not going to be enough to convict. But having a bunch of bloody money on your bed might.
Well, no, it's not on his bed. It's already in his, it's in the oven.
Oh, sure. Of course. He's moved it to the oven very strategically. How could I forget?
That's right. So that they don't light the oven, which again is a very funny Titanic reference. Okay. Are you familiar with the Titanic reference to that?
Like the 1997 film Titanic starring Leonardo DiCaprio?
Mm-hmm.
I did not know there was a reference to this movie in that.
Well, there's a reference to money being in an oven.
Ah.
So when Molly Brown is telling the story about what her husband did and that he was hiding money and he was hiding it in the oven, and then he went and lit the oven and burnt all the cash.
Ah, I see.
So it's mentioned there. And in the, I believe, 1962 movie, The Unsinkable Molly Brown, that's also mentioned. So
nice.
I like the fact that we have this idea. But I guess Mr. Green is the smart one here because he's the one who makes sure that, you know, that Rico didn't light his cigarette from, you know, by lighting the entire oven.
Yes.
So.
Thank goodness. I mean, he still did put flammable prized object into a oven. So I'm not going to give him too many high marks on that one.
No, not at all. Not at all.
Truly the worst place to hide your money. Like literally, like even the bathtub would probably be better because it could, at least you could dry it out after.
Leaving them on the bed wasn't a smart idea either.
No, that was also bad. Just like, don't run around. Like, are you Scrooge McDuck? Like, what are we doing? We need to roll around in your money.
Apparently, I wonder, do you think Scrooge McDuck did this at this point?
Oh, that's a good question. Which came first? Do you think that Scrooge McDuck is just like a low-key reference to Taking a Pelham 1-2-3?
I don't know, maybe it is.
That would be great. I'd love that. I mean, animators, they sneak stuff in all the time. So who knows?
I wonder when Scrooge McDuck was first
I think
shown.
Scrooge McDuck was first created like in the real way. It was it the 80s. So it definitely, I think this predates that.
I don't know. That's an interesting question.
You'll be doing a minute by minute review of DuckTales in your next season, right? That's you've committed
No,
to
I
that.
won't. No. Right. Okay. So I did a quick search right now, trying to find out about. Okay, Scrooge McDuck actually was in a movie in 1967.
Okay.
Called Scrooge
But
McDuck
was
and
he
Money.
so d yeah, does he dive into a into his money in that though? Because that's definitely from DuckTales. I don't know if if it appeared before
I
DuckTales.
have a feeling that it did.
Okay.
Yeah.
So maybe this is just like a deep impact Armageddon sort of thing where it's just like, just like the same idea was just in the cultural ethos at the same time.
It could be. Could be. I don't know. I mean, I like the idea that they thought of the idea of Scrooge McDuck after Mr. Green. That I love that idea, as opposed to doing the other way. Okay, he first appeared in 1947
Oh.
in a Donald Duck cartoon called Christmas on Bear Mountain.
Oh, okay.
But he only became he only became a major figure later. In the 50s, he got his own comic book series called Uncle Scrooge, which was published from 52 to 84. Wow. But it doesn't, I don't see where it says here about him jumping into his money. I don't know. Yeah, doing it does have the word jumping here. Pile of money, pile of coins. No, that's a Family Guy episode. Yeah, it doesn't say here. I could easily find it. So, but again, the probability is that Scrooge McDuck came first.
Probably.
as much as I'm disappointed about that, but yeah. So, at this point, we see Mr. Blue trying to figure out where his antagonist is, or where the guy he's facing off against is. And then the shot changes, and we're back with Garber and Daniels in the car. And Daniels finally gets a very long he gets a longer line than he's had up until then. He goes, "You better be right about this, Garber." And Garber goes, "Well, even if I am, we're probably too late."
Totally covering his behind on that one.
Yeah, and I love how we see the police car then drive by the police car that flipped over earlier, showing that they're going
Yes.
the same route. They finally brought a tow truck in to take care of that. And they
Right.
just.
And it's like, it's a funny little sight gag, but it also is a great, like, for the audience, like orienting you to like the time that has passed, right? And to the area that you're in. Like all of this stuff is happening in this really tight, like limited piece of New York City geography, right? And there hasn't been that much time that has actually moved from the last time that we were in this area, right? The tow truck had enough time to get there, but hasn't had enough time to move the car yet. So
Right.
it's like it really amps up that sort of like sense of place.
That's right. And then we can see that they're actually crossing the corner of East 9th Street and Fourth Avenue, which will be very important shortly. And as they're driving down the road, you can see in the corner a sign for the Pageant Book Company. And so I decided to look that up to see what that is. And it is actually a rare bookshop, a used and rare bookshop that's in New York City on Fourth Avenue. It was founded in 1946 by Sidney Solomon and Henry Chip Chaffetz. And they the it basically was known as the Book Row of America for 35 years because it was of where it was located. And then they relocated it around the corner to, onto East 9th Street, and they actually branched out and started selling maps and other types of prints and reprinting scholarly works and things like that. And they ended up printing the pageant facsimile of the Gutenberg Bible,
Well,
which became quite important. And
yeah.
it's a shop that has appeared in many movies, not like in this movie where you'd see the sign, but in Neil Simon's Chapter 2, James Caan and Marsha Mason go inside of it. And in Woody Allen's Hannah and Her Sisters, both Michael Caine and Barbara Hershey go into there to find a copy of E.E. Cummings' poems.
Oh, nice. That's a great movie, Hannah and Her Sisters. A New York City movie.
Yes, very much so. Most Woody Allen movies are.
Well, until he started making all those European movies, you
Right.
know.
Okay. Well, that's just because people got whatever. We're not going to go there.
No, you don't want to go there?
No, we don't need to go
You
there.
think we should stay on topic?
Yeah,
That
we don't need to go there.
digression might take us a little too long.
Yeah, apparently. And so after the two owners passed away, the daughters of one of them, the daughter of Sid Solomon, they took over, Shirley and Rebecca Solomon, and they basically in the 1990s when they started changing the whole face of New York, most of the bookstores had to either relocate or close, and they eventually basically closed all of the bookstores. And then what these two women did was is they created a website, and they started selling their books online, around the year 2000, which is pretty amazing that even at that time, they thought of doing the that type of things.
Yeah.
And they ended up reopening one shop in the East Village, which has more than 10,000 unique items in it. So it's very cool also.
Nice.
Yeah, so they reopened it in 2005. They basically had a hiatus from having a physical store between 1999 and 2005. So yeah,
Okay.
it's very cool. All right, the police car keeps going down Fourth Avenue, and then we're back watching Mr. Blue trying to figure out what he's going to be doing here. And he then takes himself a little bit out into the open, and the hippie shoots another round, so he's down to five. He's got one left at this point. But then again, if we're talking about movies, he's probably got about 20 bullets left, so it doesn't really matter.
Right.
But it's still nice to count. And then he decides to shoot back, and he shoots once, and then his second shot, we actually see it hits the hippie, who interestingly rolls over the way that he gets shot. It's interesting momentum of that that he rolls over to the left, which is not something that you necessarily would have expected.
No, it was a little bit confusing. I wasn't sure if he was like faking being shot, if we were supposed to think that he was dead now. Like, I was not entirely sure in that moment what was
I
happening.
think that part of it is that once he got shot, he rolled over in order to keep himself a little safer, maybe. I don't know. Not thinking about the third rail, but then he falls back onto the tracks. And you see him
Yeah,
holding himself, and he's sort of groaning a little bit.
If I'm him and I'm falling, like if I've been shot in the subway, the last thing I'm doing is just like casually rolling over, right? That just, it doesn't seem like that's putting me in a safer situation.
No, not at all. Not at all. And then the last 20 seconds of this minute is basically just the train continuing on its rampage, giving us a great POV shot of the train going down the tracks. And then one of the guys inside screams, "Where are those goddamn red lights?" And we have someone shout, and then we see one of the co-eds. She's I guess trying to do some sort of yoga by going whatever. I don't know if that's really gonna help the train stop, but whatever.
Yeah.
And then the
She's
old man
listen, she's
goes,
trying her best.
"Yeah." The old man goes, "There is going to be a red light. There has to be." And then one of the other passengers looks at him and goes, "What if there isn't?" When we see the mother crying, holding onto her two kids, and these people are in complete array because they have no way of knowing what's going to happen here. They all think that they are completely doomed. Do you think that again? We don't know this for sure, but do you think that the train would have derailed at some point, or they have a system set up that a train, even if it's continuing to go and is going to keep that there has to be a way to stop it.
Well, I would have thought you could have just cut the power to the train. Like, if we're being real, I would think that like none of this would happen because you could just cut the power from the train remotely. Like, because if you turn off the like, if you de like if you cut the power to the tracks, the train is going to stop. You know,
No, but
because
it's going to stop. It's going to stop too abruptly at that point. You don't want to
I
kill
don't
everyone.
know. I think like momentum would not like because it's not going to hit like a wall or anything. It's just like you cut the power. Momentum would still run, would it would just slowly like glide to a stop, I think, like in real life.
I don't know. Think about if you're
I'm not
driving your
a
car and
train
you slam
engineer,
on.
so
No,
I
I know
might
that.
not be
But
right.
think if you're driving your car and you slam on the brakes, you're not going to
Right,
gradually stop. It's.
but if you're cutting power, that's not the same thing as your brake slamming on the brakes, right? That's more like all of a sudden you run out of gas. Like your
Yeah.
wheels are still going to be in motion. There's just going to be no power coming to them, so you'll
Maybe.
slowly stop. So I think in real life that's what would happen. But I
Okay.
also think in real life, if the train cars were going 70 miles an hour, it would only take one sharp turn, and there's plenty of sharp turns down there to derail the train. So I think that could have also, depending on like, a lot of the tracks are mostly straight, but there are some pretty weird turns down there. So if you ran into that, I think that could also be a dangerous problem. But I really do think that this could have been handled remotely if this was real life. Certainly now, maybe not then, but definitely now. But again, I am not an electrical engineer. I don't work for the MTA. I can't speak with any authority.
Okay, fair enough. Did you have?
Unlike our old man on the
That's
train
right.
tracks, despite the fact that I have ridden on the subway many times, I am not an expert on how trains work.
But now, well, now at least you know about the idea that they have a trip clock, on the train.
Yes.
So if you're ever on a train that's going out of control, just tell people, "Don't worry, there's a trip clock here," and
Yes,
that's
I'm sure
fine.
that will relieve them right away.
Completely. Completely. I've seen the Taking of Pelham 1-2-3.
And
All
they'll be
right.
like, that Denzel Washington movie?
Yeah, they're like, no. All
Do you
right.
think that there's a long sequence about a trip cock in the Denzel version? I don't
I don't remember, and I don't want to remember.
know. Okay.
I probably should rewatch it at some point. Especially after
Fair.
doing
I'm sure
90
it's
minutes.
fun.
Especially doing 90 minutes of this movie so far. Right? Maybe it's about time that I rewatch it. Who knows?
You got it. If you're gonna watch it though, you gotta do the double feature of Unstoppable and Taking a Pelham 1-2-3, just back to back.
Yeah.
And then honestly, make it a whole afternoon, watch Flight also to get the triple
It's true.
transit disaster.
There you go. But one of them is on drugs and the other is not.
That's true. But hey, out of the three of them, I think he performs best in the one that he is on drugs. So, you know, that's because Flight is a hell of a movie.
That's because it's Zemeckis. So there you
Yeah.
go. Zemeckis and John Goodman. That's what makes the movie.
Oh man, John Goodman in Flight is just out of control. He's so wonderful. That movie is like a mess, but John Goodman is incredible.
All right. So every Friday we have a segment called Fun City Friday, where my guests will give their top five New York centric movies. So once again, why don't you start with your number five and work your way up?
Yes, so I'm very excited about this. Obviously, there's like a million movies that have been set in New York over the years. Many of them mean a lot to me. I lived in New York as well. New York is an important city for me. I love New York, unironically. So there's a lot of places that I could go, a lot of directions that I could choose for this. But I'm very happy with this list of five. Starting out, if you've listened to all of our episodes together from this week, I alluded to an episode, a movie that might come up in my top five, one of my top fives. It's here. It's in my top five New York City movies. And it's a movie called The Wedding Banquet, which originally came out in 1993. It's an Ang Lee film from very start of his career. It's his only his second movie. Really underseen, underappreciated. They just, Bowen Yang and Lily Gladstone just made a remake of it that came out this past summer, also called The Wedding Banquet, which is a very sweet, nice movie, and it is a it updates the story in ways that mostly work, but I think ultimately the impact and the power of the first film stands above the remake. So I would definitely recommend checking this version of it out. Also, the remake does not take place in New York, and this one does, so wouldn't be eligible for this list anyway. But it's a lovely film. It's basically the story is that there is a Taiwanese man who is living in New York. He is gay. He has a boyfriend who has been living with him for quite some time. They're in a serious long-term relationship. But the Taiwanese man's family, still in Taiwan, is unaware of his sexuality, has been pushing him to meet someone, to get married, settle down. He's in his 30s now. It's time, right? Meanwhile, the Taiwanese man and his partner, they have a property, like a resident, like residential property that they're the landlords of, and their tenant is this Chinese immigrant who is struggling to maintain her green card status because she's an artist, she's a painter, she keeps having a hard time maintaining a job because of this. And so they work out this arrangement. They say, hey, look, my mom and dad is really pressuring me to get married. You need a green card. How about we just get married? We'll tell them that we're married. They're old. They're never going to come here. It'll be fine. And this will solve all of our problems, right? So they decide to do this. They write home, say they're getting married. And of course, as you might expect, mom and dad from Taiwan come to America, come to New York City to meet their new daughter-in-law and throw a big wedding. And a lot of really funny moments, a lot of really sweet moments ends up happening along the way. It's setting up like a kind of a farcical, sort of silly movie. And it has elements of that, but it's actually like a much more heartfelt and humanist film than the setup might let you believe. And it's really just a truly wonderful like family drama about like acceptance and about understanding and about miscommunications. And it's a very tender film. And if you've seen other Ang Lee films from like, you know, whether you were talking about Brokeback Mountain, or you're talking about, you know, Ride with the Devil, or you know, The Ice Storm. He does so many different types of films, but all of them at their heart is about like family connections and those bonds and tender love stories. And this is an early example of that that very few people have seen and everyone should check out. So I wanted to start out with The Wedding Banquet at number five.
Well, I gotta tell you, Alex, I haven't seen either of them. You finally found a movie I haven't seen. There you go.
Yeah, nice.
But
I hope you check it out.
by the time this airs, I will check off both of those. So don't worry about
Okay,
it.
very cool. Now, this next one I think you probably have seen or at least have heard of. It's a little film from 2004 called Spider-Man 2.
I've never
starring
heard of
Tobey
it.
Maguire.
Never heard of it.
Yeah. Now, obviously, I'm a superhero fan. I had to get a superhero movie on the list. There's lots of superhero movies that take place in New York, but the most iconic, most indelible New York superhero movie is Spider-Man 2. It's a movie made shortly after 9/11. There's this whole sequence in it where, like, all of New York comes together to help Spider-Man save the day. It's very moving and heartwarming. There's a sequence on the train, which where everybody kind of stands up and helps him. But it also, like, Superman is a Spider-Man rather is the quintessential New York City hero, and I think this is the quintessential Spider-Man film. There's probably other Spider-Man films that I personally like more, but this is the most New York City. It's the one that you really feel the sense of the city, the sense of the him being this working class kid, trying to make it in Manhattan, trying to make his like he's in college, he's trying to deliver pizzas, but he's also trying to be Spider-Man, and it's all so much, and it's all hard, and he can't handle it, and all of that stuff. It's just a great like what it's like to hustle and to work hard in New York City, but also you're a superhero. So I think in a list of iconic New York City movies, it belongs in that conversation. My number three, Alfred Hitchcock, film called Rear Window from 1954. Very different vibe from Spider-Man and The Wedding Banquet, but iconic New York City movie nonetheless. Why I include it here, obviously it's a classic film. If you don't know, it's like Jimmy Stewart, he broke his leg, he's bored, he gets a telescope, he looks into his neighbor's window, it looks like his neighbor has murdered his wife, and intrigue continues from there. What I like about it is you're live like New York City is one of the most overpopulated places in the world, right? The most densely populated places in the world. Millions of people pushed against each other. You're looking through, you're engaging with so many different people's lives in an instant, like through just like fleeting moments, all day, every day. That's just an intrinsic part of being in any city to some degree, but definitely in New York City. And I think this captures the sort of so many different interesting layers to that, like to being around so many people who you can see, but who you don't know, and you'll never really know, but you can see them and they're right there, and you're going to make assumptions about them, you're going to read into situations, you're going to develop these kind of melodramas for these people. And what does that say about them? What does that say about you? What does that say about the city that you're all sharing, right? I think it's a great thriller on its own, but when you think about it in the context of New York, it's perfect. And it's this great set that they built to capture this sort of courtyard. It's got a great physical quality to it. So wonderful, wonderful, I think iconic New York City film.
All right, excellent.
Another film, number two for me, 1960, we're moving up a little bit. It's The Apartment, Billy Wilder's apartment. Jack Lemmon plays C.C. Baxter. He's this guy down on his luck. He's just trying to get ahead in his corporate job. He's lonely. He's sad. He lets his buddies and his higher ups use his apartment for their mistresses.
None of them are his
Just.
buddies. They're all his bosses.
They're not really his buddies, no. But I think in his mind, there's this sense that maybe we're developing some sort of relationship that's transactional, but I don't really like you, but maybe, whatever. But they're all just using him. He thinks there's going to be some opportunistic benefit to him down the road, but there's not going to be, most likely. And in any case, during this process, he finds out that the girl who works in the elevator and he has a crush on her, turns out she's sleeping with his boss, using his apartment to do it. His boss is a dick. He sucks. He's breaking this girl's heart, which is breaking Jack Lemmon's heart because he loves her. And it's just this beautiful, sad, sweet movie about what it's like to be like lonely in the city, about how you feel alienated and isolated and just like desperate for connection. And then like that feeling when you get that connection and when you're able to kind of build something with someone else through these like insane situations that could only happen in New York, And it's just a lovely movie about that romanticism and also that alienation. And that's why I think I really like that, because that is so much of the experience of being young in New York City. You have those dueling experiences always. You always, at least, not always, but in many cases, you get both of that sense of that romanticism of New York and the alienation of New York. And I think that The Apartment really captures both in a really profound way. And it also gets to be fun and
Yeah, I
romantic.
love The Apartment.
It's excellent. My number one, another film that is quintessentially New York from 1989, it's Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing. I mean, I think that I don't really need to go into that detail on why Do the Right Thing is a classic film, classic New York film. It captures this moment that happens every year in New York City when it gets to be just too hot for too long and everyone starts to go a little bit crazy. And what it's like when that happens, when you're just like so physically oppressed by the atmosphere or the environment that everything that has been boiling under the surface just rushes to the surface and it all sort of explodes. And there's so much interesting like conversations about neighborhoods and about the complexity and the socioeconomic and racial and class, all of that stuff banging into each other in New York City in 1989, but in a way that really it feels so modern in its understanding of politics and society. It feels like it could have been made yesterday and be just as relevant. It's an incredible cast of young actors who, many of whom you've now seen in a million things as they've aged. And it's just an iconic piece of cinema that I think was, has only grown in estimation as we've gotten further and further from its release. And it's so relevant to today and to yesterday and to 20 years ago and 30 years ago before that. So, and it's fun, it's exciting, it's sexy, it's got great music, it's got like everything that a fantastic movie about New York City should have. So it's got to be number one on the list for me.
Excellent. Okay, thank you very much. Okay, we will now play Name That Remake one final time.
Okay, one last time.
One last time. Let's spin the wheel. Four different, there's three remakes that are made of this movie.
Oh.
Yes. Okay. A group of reporters need to deal with something with a sensational event that is happening as the story continues to unfold. So the original came out in 1931. There was a remake in 1940. There was another remake in 1974, and another remake in 1988.
74, 88, 30,
31 and 40.
and 40. And it's about reporters dealing with a sensational.
Event that is happening as the story goes on. So the movie from 1931 and 1974 have the exact same name. The other two have different titles.
Invasion of the Body Snatchers?
What does that have to do with reporters?
I don't know. I was hoping that they were reporters and
No, the
that were
reporter you're
having
dealing
their body snatched.
with a political it's like a political story that's going on.
Huh. Is it the front page?
Yes, it is. Very good.
Ah, okay.
So you have the front page from 1931, His Girl Friday from 1940, the
Yes.
front page again from 1974, and then the 1988 version was switching channels with Christopher Reeve and Kathleen Turner.
Oh, okay. See, I have never heard of that last one at all. So that's why I was a little bit thrown. But okay, cool. I got there. That was good.
Yeah,
Second try.
good. Very nice. Excellent. All right, Alex, would you like for one final time this season to tell everyone where they can find you?
Yes, you can follow me on Blue Sky at Alex Marcus. You can follow me on Letterboxd at Media Thinkings. You can follow all the work that I do in podcasting by going to thepopbreak.com. Click on the podcast tab. You'll see all the podcasts that I supervise, I edit, I produce, I sometimes host. You can also subscribe to The Pop Break on all major podcasting platforms. Over there, you'll see my main podcast, Bill versus the MCU, where you can hear me and the editor-in-chief of thepopbreak.com, Bill Bodkin, talking all about Marvel. We've talked about the first five phases of the MCU. We've talked about the X-Men franchise. We've talked about the Marvel Defenders shows. We've talked about Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. We've talked about Blade and Daredevil and Elektra and all that stuff. Right now, what we're talking about is the Marvel animation slate from the last few years, including Your Friendly Neighborhood Spider-Man, Eyes of Wakanda, and most recently, Marvel Zombies. So you check that out wherever you get your podcasting. Also, you can subscribe to my podcast, It's Tomplicated, a Tom Holland podcast. It's co-hosted with Manish Mathar. We are devoted to the filmography of Tom Holland twice a month, every month until July 2026, when he has his big month when The Odyssey, Christopher Nolan's Odyssey, and Spider-Man Brand New Day will be coming out. Until then, we're covering all of his films, all of his TV shows, all of his stage performances, even some viral clips. So check that out wherever you get your podcasting as well.
All right, excellent. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on my website, moviearoundminute.com. If you want to send me an email, you can send it to moviearoundminute@movieround.net. I'm available on Facebook, on Twitter, and on Instagram. So I will be back again tomorrow. We will have two special weekend episodes tomorrow and Sunday. And next week also, we will be going through the weekend in order to finish things off as this movie gets closer to the end. So until tomorrow,
Gesundheit.